Thank you very much. After having a refresher course in Pizza Hut for dinner, having seen the and experienced the evolution of Pizza Hut from a purveyor of flavored cardboard to a really good industry in which pizza tastes very, very fine and seems to whet the compulsive side of my desire to eat. I come to you satisfied with a dinner provided by the pastor, certainly by the church, and I'll be leaving tomorrow morning very early, so this will give me a chance to say a couple of things. I want to thank the pastor and his staff for the enormity of their welcome, the genuineness of their hospitality, and the care that they've shown my colleague and me during these last few days. It's been very, very delightful. I have thought many, many times about the generosity of the congregation, the audience, whatever name we can call them. While they have listened their way through some fairly thick presentations and have been most receptive and wonderfully courteous, and I thank them for that. And for the acquaintances that I've made, the friendships that have been struck up ever so quickly, but nonetheless long-lasting, I want to thank you all for the beauty in your faces that comes out of being living under the light of the Lord, letting His light shine on us and you to the extent to which people are drawn to the light of our shining. That's the beginning, I think, of Isaiah 60. The fascination of that scripture to me is that the light that is certainly reflected off of our faces comes first of all from God, and then it becomes incarnate somehow so that it doesn't look like a cosmetic light that is applied from the outside, but it works its way in and then shines its way out. And then the fascinating part of that scripture is that the people are drawn to the light of our shining, which gives us the responsibility of not taking credit for it. Even though I remember once I was walking in a mall with my late wife, and I innocently asked her, in a world that doesn't often smile, it doesn't take the initiative by smiling, I said, "Honey, why is it that it seems that wherever we walk, people kind of smile at us?" I said, "I know you're pretty and I'm not. But," I said, "why is that?" And she had this innocent, uncontrived humility that were these words that I'm about to say to come out of a conceited mouth. They would embarrass me, but she said, "Well, I know why." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Because of the glory of the Lord shining through us." And she was the kind of person who took no credit for that. By the same token, with regard to a little bit more about our love for each other, one morning, way into our marriage, I said, "Sweetheart, you have the prettiest eyes." I said, "I've always noticed that, but I just feel like I need to tell you that this morning." And again, in this innocent confidence, she said, "I know it." And I knew that I could trust those words. She knew that she was pretty, but she didn't make any big deal out of it, which made her beauty all the more desirable, the lack of pretentious knowledge about how one looks. And when she said very calmly, without smiling, she says, "I know it," I thought, this is the lady whose examples of personal authority, clothed in humility and wrapped in beauty, this is a lady who will be perpetually loved, not just by me, but by everybody who comes in contact with her. But returning to my initial words, thank you very much for this time here. We're talking as well as we can tonight about the educational side of the life of the church, which means the educational side of the doctrines of the church, the educational side of the driving force of the church, the triune God, the educational side of a completed theology of worship, in terms of which the essence of worship does not lie in walking into or out of a classroom or into or out of a worship service. We've been over all of that, and I don't want to hammer that again, but we're still talking about unceasing worship when we talk about Christian education. And the only thing is we're doing it under a different rubric, that is that of teaching. And again, that knits in more than to simply the educational arm of the local church. You are the teachers. It knits into the life of the pulpit pastorate. It knits into the lives of the musicians and others who coordinate worship. And amazingly enough, it reaches into the lives of every member of the congregation, whether they're known as teachers or not. In that, their lives cannot, even in the most narcissistic context, be completely shut in within their personhood. Something will exude, or should exude, from every Christian practitioner of anything, whether they're carpenters or plumbers or doctors or nurses or highway workers or politicians or what. Something should exude from them, especially when they're lit up from the inside by Christ, that will inform the teaching arm of the church something more about teaching. A lot of people will go to big conceptual definitions as to what makes a teacher. These are often very, very good, but they're always after the fact. You look at a teacher and find out they're a good teacher, and then you define what it means to be a teacher by using their talents as a model for the definition you want to create. And if it were just an abstract definition, it would be as stale and cold and as desirable as a dead mouse. It wouldn't do much. So I'd like to go at just the thing that has come to strike me about the art and the craft of teaching that I'd like to pass on to you. And the first would be the word art and the word craft. They're so easily confused. And the artistic side of plumbing, let me start way off the center traditional definition of art. The art of plumbing, or the art of sewing up a hem, the art of automobile mechanics, the art of flying an airplane, has to do with the imagination of the in the life of the person who does these jobs. The art is learning how to get out of a pickle, for instance. I've often said that a performing artist is at his or her best if they know how to play themselves out of trouble. I know what it means to play myself into trouble with all of the studies I've had in performances, performance and all the bad experiences I've had as a performer when suddenly my mind goes blank. Or I become self-conscious about what I'm doing and I begin to think about playing what I'm playing instead of playing without thinking about playing what I'm playing. And the art of improvisation within the task of doing anything partly is negative, that is, learning how to get your way out of trouble. Given the fact that none of us can do anything what we do perfectly, given the fact that we're prone to trouble, irrespective of our level of intelligence or anything like that. But the art, negatively speaking, is learning to if you find yourselves in a jam, knowing imaginatively how to craft your way out of the jam. And the art of teaching, or the art of nursing, or the art of surgery has to do with the imaginative side, the stylistic side, the personally idiosyncratic side of doing anything. And I want to dignify every vocation there is by the use of the word art, by talking about the use of the imagination in whatever task we undertake. That's where art, capital A-R-T, it really is partly funded by the use of the imagination. If we were to use a biblical definition of creativity, or look at God as the quintessential creator, we would say that God's creatorhood is a combination of imagining and crafting. He thinks something up, that's imagination. He puts it together, that's craft. And the same thing is true of what I've been trying to say about all occupations, all walks of life, and whatever. The use of the imagination is quintessential. It is not ever worked into the methods, but it sort of drives methodology. It puts poetry, human individuality around the abstract, systematical list of methods. And methods are important, don't get me wrong, but not by themselves. They have to be fueled by the individual imagination that takes these learned methods and makes them into a poetic device, which in turn fires the imagination of the learner. And so the art is transferable, imagination calling to imagination. The craft side is doing everything in such a way that it is immediately obvious that you've done your job well and you can communicate what you're doing. That's the craft part. Let's talk about, well, even with a certain reservation, the new Boeing 787, which is in a little bit of trouble right now because despite the art of designing that plane, which is an incredible piece of aerodynamic design coupled to aesthetics, it's a beautiful plane, but it also flies. And the imagination coupled to a full knowledge of Newton's laws and aerodynamic theory and things like that led to the crafting of an airplane, which now is in trouble because of one little minuscule part in the crafting of the plane. The imagination had already said this plane will need X, Y, and Z contained within its aesthetic shape and its aerodynamic capabilities, but the designers had nothing to say about a battery. Well, now, what is Boeing doing? They are imagining and crafting. They're in a jam, and they have to be so good at what they're doing that they can play their ways out of the jam. The same way a performer playing a Beethoven sonata gets in a jam, has to play his way out of trouble. Right now, the imagination at a micro level in Boeing is being used to figure out a way out of this trouble, and it will eventually end up with the crafting of a new battery that will hopefully solve the issue. And so that wonderful amalgamation of imagination and craft, thinking up and making, is of the essence. It begins with God, who is the infinite imaginer and the infinite crafter. It's extended to us by virtue of his gift to us of making us in his image, which allows us to imagine and craft. That's the what we would call creativity. Creativity is not an art word, it's a human word. In the sense that creator and creation is not God is not the quintessential artist. That limits him. He's the quintessential union of infinite imagination and infinite crafting capabilities. We are finite, and instead of thinking up and making something out of nothing, we think up something out of something and craft it into something else. So if I go out into the woods and cut down a tree, I have to be sure, and I want to make a house out of it, I have to be sure that I've imagined a lot of things. the look of the house, the shape of the house, things like that. But in order to craft the house, I have to cut the tree down. It has to be made kill-dried. It has to be cut into timbers and so on and so forth. And then we start talking about hardware and so on and so forth. And all these imagining craftsmen come in and they frame and they plumb, they wire, they interior decorate and so on and so forth. And if all of these imaginings and craftings have integrity and are of a high order, you will live in a house that won't break for a while. And so it goes. Please try to assume that you don't join a strange citizenry by becoming a teacher. It's not a strange citizenry. It's set apart in other ways that I want to get to. But above all, you are image of God, which reduces everybody at the get-go to complete equality, one with the other. And from that general gift of being made in God's image, then God, out of that, creates individuals in whom his image shows different ways. That's individuality. But the created reality of being human is image of God. And nobody is more image of God than anybody else. We cannot say that Albert Einstein was more image of God than Harold Best, who plods around the low ground of imagination and craft. We're equally image of God. God doesn't dose us up differentially because he's no respecter of persons. So the glory of your, above all, glory of your humanhood is that you can look around and say, we are at base equal. What does that do to racial relations? It talks of equality in a completely different way, and the loss of equality doesn't turn out just to be a social issue. It's spitting in God's face, who made everybody equal, imago Dei. So in that respect, think of the glory of teaching as part of the ordinariness of being made in the image of God, who can certainly be defined as the eternally greatest teacher ever. If we want to talk about God pedagogically and talk about Jesus pedagogically, we're talking about the Father and the Son being above all the best teachers ever. And the story of redemption that takes up the entirety of the Bible in one way or another is the quintessential piece of teacherliness that we'll ever find. Thanks be to God. We're dealing with primary resource all the time as Christians. Nothing better than the Trinity is superbly above and beyond. The revelation of the Trinity is superlatively eternally secure and fast. It can't be changed. Heaven and earth will pass away, but God's word will never pass away. All of our primary resources are, to use a cultural word, first class. And so we go into the glory of teaching. So I still haven't quite gotten to what I would like to say, what makes a teacher a teacher. And I want to just speak kind of earthy right now and say, anybody who has an incessant itch to say, guess what, is it? That's where teachers have to start. Otherwise, they should probably think of something else to do. I don't know about you, but I've been a teacher. And I remember as a little kid, everything I learned, I imagined myself immediately telling somebody about it. Whatever I learned from my dad or from a book or something like that, I wanted to say, guess what? And it's sort of like a person walking, I'm walking behind a person, somebody else is walking ahead of me, and a thought comes to me, I've got a tent. She said, and I run up to that person from behind and I tap him on the shoulder and I say, guess what? You know, and the surprise with which they turn sort of is a kind of like gasoline. It'll catch fire because they're surprised. And guess what? What? Well, I learned today something about the expansion of steam in a cylinder that when it's heated up and superheated, it wants to expand 2,000 times to its size. And that's why a cylinder this big around, one on each side of a locomotive, can pull a freight train a half mile long. Guess what? You know, and look at your parenting. Are you guess whaters? Everything you learn, you want to say, guess what? In your Christian life, you find something about Jesus. The scriptures light up, and your soul is somehow widened, even a fraction of a spiritual inch. And you want to say, I've got to tell somebody about this. Now, we've narrowed that down into what we call witness. And I think we've cheapened the word by boxing it in to a certain thing we do with scripture verses. And that's why so much witness is fruitless, because it doesn't have the guess what in it. It doesn't have the imagination of working Jesus into any conversation undertaken by any kind of a tradesperson and finding out enough about the way that person does their imagining and crafting so that you can go to them, whatever your imagining and crafting jobs are, and you've studied humanity enough. And by golly, that's all we should be doing in addition to studying Jesus. This rotten, lousy, lost world with gorgeous images of God in it that are lost and crumbling, we've got to find out how they work. We've got to find out how they think. When Paul said, I want to be all things to all men so that by all means I might win some, he wasn't talking about our silly versions of relevance. I need to be all things to this community, which means I have to find out this, that, and the other thing, and then do that in such a way as to attract them here. No, because if this were a community full of whorehouses, that would mean you have to learn a little bit about prostitution in order to attract them here. That's not the point. Paul's point is you have to understand the worldviews of ever so many kinds of people, why they think, why they put their thoughts and actions together in the way they do based on something core about something important to them. And then you have to think like them in order to debate with them. You have to outgun their thinking. You don't counter their thinking by blowing them over with a scripture verse that makes no sense to them. Now, sometimes that's important and necessary. Don't get me wrong. But I don't think it's primary to box witness up into abstract formulae that make no connection to how they think, what they believe, wherever they are, and so on and so forth. But if you know how a mechanic thinks, if you know how an accountant thinks, if you know how an artist thinks, if you know how a politician tries to think, and if you know how a lawyer tries to think in as many ways possible so as to speak in tongues, in the courtroom that is, so that everybody's confused, won over, and condemned at all at the same time, you've got to figure out how to do that. Because you're not going to get into their heads unless you have become all things to them. You have learned to think the way they do, and then you have the remedy that outguns that way of thinking. That's teacherliness. And so this urge to say, guess what, is based on the study, the love of, the digestion, and the ability to analyze and counter any number of ways of thinking and worldviews. Now, that has to do with the overall art and craft of teaching. The difference can only, as far as I'm concerned, be looked at that way. So I would end up this little introductory thing by saying that all teachers should be teacherly. That's the other way of saying it. Being a teacher is not applied from the outside with a diploma, a certificate, or a dedication service in the front of the sanctuary when the new teaching staff is dedicated to the Lord and somehow a mantle is put on them. That's all maybe necessary, but a teacher, before they're ever called such, must be teacherly. and teacherliness is that urge to say, guess what? Which means that nobody's exempted. Parents have to be teacherly. They might not be teachers by profession, but they have to be teacherly, guess whaters, in the same way that Jesus, guess what, guess what? Well, Master, we don't quite understand. Well, let me say it to you by way of a parable. Okay, but show us a sign. Well, and so on and so forth. Guess what, always outgunning and stepping ahead of the questioner. So that is something I hope comforts you, especially when you're tempted to think that you don't have the skills to be a teacher. This teacher has maybe a bachelor's degree in elementary education and makes his or her living on the outside of the walls of the sanctuary by teaching. I don't. I've never done that. Am I in the same league? You are, if you can imagine and craft the question, guess what, and the follow-through, here's how, and here's what. And please take comfort in that. That would be, in a broad scriptural sense, making your calling and election sure, without referring to labels or certificates or anything like that. Now, let me talk a little bit about God as creator with regard to the most, I think, neglected generation of people in church, little children. If there's any failing within the contemporary worship-driven, worship music-driven church, to whatever degree it is messed up that way or very refined, as I think this church is, there's still a gross neglect of children going on. Yeah, we have children's education, and we have perhaps Sunday school or something called similar to that. But the larger dimensions of childhood are grossly ignored. Let me, without knowing how you do it, let me say why I think this is true. One of the great linguists in the world, whose name is Noam Chomsky, teaches at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and whose political worldview frankly stinks to high heaven and back, is nonetheless a wise man who in his linguistic theories speaks beautiful theology without knowing it. He's one of these examples of common grace where God calls his wisdom down on the unjust and furnishes them with the most elegant kinds of thinking or doing that humankind knows. Chomsky is one of those people who, in a definition I'm going to, or a little statement I'm going to give you in a minute, I'm sure never thought of God. Noam Chomsky, and this will not get too technical, but it's exciting. Guess what? Chomsky's linguistic theory is based on what is called deep structure, that all human languages in the world are bound together not by meaning each other, but by working the same way. Deep structure. All languages, on the simple end of it, have nouns, verbs, and tenses, and so on and so forth. But there are 1,000 ways of putting them together. Some languages have a verb at the beginning of the sentence, and the same verb expressed another way in the middle of the sentence, and then another one at the end of the sentence, far more complex than English. The Germans put the verb at the end of the sentence, and sometimes you have to wait an hour and a half to know what the verb is, whereas English puts the verb pretty far up front. Adjectives and nouns can appear in different order and so on and so forth. You all know that. Well, you magnify that by the fact that this world of New Guinea alone contains almost 1,000 languages, separate and unparalleled, and then you multiply that by world ethnology. You know that other than for the kind of thinking of Noam Chomsky, this would truly be Babel. And there's a wonderful theology that, as a sidelight, you can construct about the difference between Babel and Pentecost. People tried to build toward heaven when they built Babel and said, God says, enough of this, I'm going to confuse them. Pentecost, God rains down from heaven, and everybody hears in the same language. It's a wonderful contrast. It makes some great Bible studies and preaching. Here's what Chomsky said. Listen to this carefully. I'm going to say it enough times that if you want to write it down, it's one sentence. Children are born into this world. Let me say it once and don't write. Get the whole thought in your heads. Children are born into this world bringing the sentence with them. We just give them words. Say it again. Children are born into this world bringing the sentence with them. We just give them words. Now, that's shocking and shockingly true. Now, break the definition down, or the statement down, to the extent to which you can first of all say that when Chomsky said that, he was not just talking about spoken language and the addition of bringing words to that innate sentence that children bring with them. Think of every communicative language possible, the language of the arts, the language of science, the languages of mathematics, the languages of what we would call mechanical engineering, or anything like any language. Because when you think of all the things that everybody does, they have to start at the beginning and end up at the end, however long that sentence is, and it has to make sense. Think of the sentence as not as a spoken sentence, but think of the sentence in the Chomskyan sense of an entity that has to hold together by making its way throughout itself. You follow that? If you don't, say so, or I'll try to say it again. That was not perhaps the best way to say it. A sentence is its own powerhouse by beginning a certain way and having to follow through organizationally and propositionally to the end, to the point when you come here, everything makes sense. That is the inborn sentence he's been talking about. That's where that is gloriously theological. God is the quintessential eternal sentence. Everything in him coheres, makes sense, follows through, whatever you want to call it, nouns, verbs, adjectives of all kinds, not just grammar, but things that hold things together. That desire to say, when I start something, I have to follow through in such a way that when I come to the period, whether it's here or 10 miles out there, it is sensible. Chomsky says that children are born with this, bringing the sentence with them. That is so innate. It has to be begun and it has to be finished. That is one of the most stunning, stunning things, that everything in creation works that way. Everything works according to how a sentence works. Not a language sentence, but the stringing together of this, that, and the other thing, to the extent to which, when you begin and end, you have completed something that has absolute meaning. Makes sense. It works. You follow that. Then that stunningly, almost frightening thing that he follows through with, he says, and we just give them words. Think of cultural sentences. The cultural sentences are pretty sordid today. Culture is in a mess. And I'm not talking about how the way people talk. Remember, I'm talking about how culture puts itself together so that from beginning to end, you know what you mean. Those are the words that we throw culturally in to the cultural sentence. Economic words that we throw into the economic sentence. Musical words, not text, but musical actions, the way they comprise the sentence, and so on and so forth. The words are the cultural part. that vary from practice to practice to practice, from culture to culture to culture, from medium to medium to medium. The musical words that we use in Western culture derive out of 12 pitches and an innate sense of using those 12 pitches so that you start at home and you end up at home. That's called tonality. If you decide that you don't want that and you don't want to start out with a tonal home and a tonal ending, you do something atonal, beginning, and atonal and ending. And I know you might not know what 12-tone atonal writing is, but it's music that is completely dissonant. It has no harmony in it because there's no home anywhere. Now, the interesting thing about that, the grammar for doing that is stricter, because I've written 12-tone music, is stricter than trying to write music that has a home and it goes a little bit away from home and then comes back home. Nonetheless, these are all sentences. So think of the sentences, the words that we put in this innate human gift called wanting to put things together so that they make sense. It is a stunning way of talking about Imago Dei and then of talking about how we are rescued from the fall with all the bad words in all of the kinds of sentences. And then think of what redemption does. It can't change the sentence. This innate urge to work something through so that it makes sense. That's given in birth. But all the words, how do we act culturally? How do we act ecclesiastically? How do we act with money? How do we act with all of these things? What do we do with our desires to put things together? And Christianity, as we well know, gives us the final answer to that. But we're still not very good at practicing it because we're all somewhere along the road of salvation and no two people are at exactly the same place. We can only talk about comparative spirituality and only God can hold the conversation. We can't because we can't judge. The same thing about giftedness. All of us here are variously gifted, but in the variation of our giftedness, we're unequally gifted with other people with the same gift. Some teachers are better than others. Some musicians are better than others. Some lawyers are better than others. Some plumbers are better than others. And the plumbing sentence, how do you make this thing work so that when you flush it, it doesn't end up as if you were on a cruise ship? That's the plumbing sentence. How does it work? The architectural sentence. How does a building stand up no matter how it looks? The words that you put into the building, the constructional words, all of these things that are supposed to keep a building standing up, if the grammar's wrong, in that sentence, the building's going to fall over. The sentence, the urge to articulate the sentence was filled with bad grammar. It fell over. I have two books at home. One of them is called Why Do Buildings Stand Up? Written by an engineer, and another one written by an engineer, Why Do Buildings Fall Down? And it's the story of a lot of building collapses that had nothing to do with airplanes being crashed into them or anything else. They just fell down. Why did they fall down? And it's always a mistake in grammar. Something in the sentence was wrong. You follow that? It's thick and rich. Don't ever quit thinking about it. Not because I said it, but because a man as wise as Noam Chomsky came along and said this. Well, when you apply this to the sentence that children bring with them in birth to the words we give them, then we can... Get into the psychology of learning without being psychologists with children. We have to remember this. Children are born into the world with the most vivid imaginative sentence known to humankind. Imagination is richest with a child because it works like a sponge. The child has almost no words, but has the sense in him and her. They are on the lookout without our knowing it all the time. All the time. Christ didn't say, except you become as little children, to tell us to behave like little children, because if we don't, we like it or not, our children are the most narcissistic of human beings. They demand attention inevitably and constantly, and it's all for themselves. Part of civilization is to teach narcissism out of a child so that in some ways they become socially capable. They become good communicators. They reach out. They want to be nurses. They want to be doctors. They want to help. That does not come, that is not part of the sentence. I would argue that in a way, children are at their most fallen when they're first born. They have no concept of helping anybody else. But they have an imagination that is as wide as the ocean, and they are multilingual learners. They are learning simultaneously at a speed that we can't imagine. A child is the person to teach Spanish and German, Chinese, and all these languages too at once. And they'll soak them up because they don't know that they're learning grammar. They're not going through the mechanical paces of all of this. That's why children's art often looks more abstract than real. Why? Because they understand art better. They understand that the beauty of the image is more important than what the image is supposed to represent. They know that. And in a way, they shame us because we always want a painting to look like it has a horse in it, or a barn, or whatever. And if it doesn't, then we think something's wrong with the world. This person must be a sinner because the world is broken apart to the extent they don't even know what reality is anymore. That's a horrible judgment of art. I was saying last night that God is the first abstract artist. Why? Because the first elephant, for instance, he made out of nothing. He didn't have one to copy. He didn't have one to paint. And you can imagine Gabriel standing next to him saying, "Sir, what is that?" You know, seeing that elephant. I haven't seen like that anything like that before. And God said, "Well, that's just the point of what it means to think of something out of nothing. That's just the point." And did my card go on? Yeah, right here. Children are so precious in that respect. They're wildly hungry and wildly imaginative. And what does education do because it forgets the sentence and this incredible imagination? You can argue that education turns poetry into grammar, generally, generically. We teach them words, but not only do we teach them words, we say, and here are the rules for putting the words together. And if we don't do that right, we shut imagination down. And kids that had these innate multiple gifts, they can sing, they can draw, they can dance. Goodness sake, watch a kid dance. And then we teach them how to barn dance, let's say, or a square dance. Okay, fine. But if we get too precious about that, we might kill their ability to dance any other way, which they are born with. They're born to be multilingual dancers. I don't know how else to say this, except please understand that you're dealing with the Imago Dei at its most vulnerable and at its most hungry when you're dealing with children. And don't be afraid of what they imagine. And if, as a story I heard, you asked him during Christmas time to draw a little picture of something about Christmas, and a little kid draws a jet airplane with four people in it, and you say to him, "Well, could you tell me, Johnny, about how this relates to Christmas?" "Well, that was the flight into Egypt." "Okay, but there are four people in it." "Well, there's Mary and the baby Jesus and Joseph." "Well, who's the fourth person?" "Well, that's Pontius the Pilate." You know, let that happen. Don't correct them doctrinally. Say, "You know, that's pretty neat. You know, I wish I'd think of the word Pilate instead of Pilatus." Which I, when I see a Pilatus or whatever that is you do on these big bouncy balls, I think of Pontius Pilate, and for some reason or other. But, you know, you go on and on and on, that's my stupid imagination still at work. And the betrayal of the human frame by getting on a ball and being given over to something. So, that's about all I want to say in a conceptual way. I've probably gone over time, for which I thank myself. And you didn't get that. But just to let you know that you're dealing with multiply gifted learners. There's a whole new science of multiple intelligences, wherein it's being discovered that all people are multiply gifted in intelligence. There's not just one kind. There's musical intelligence and imagistic intelligence. There's verbal intelligence, so on and so forth. This is why I say the church is neglecting children horribly. And we have to step in the place of the public schools, which is neglecting them in a systemically negative way quite often. Now, if there are any public school teachers here, I'm not condemning you. You know, I hope you know something of what I mean. That you have an understanding between you and the Lord that your licensure as a public school teacher is subordinate to your call to teach. And without talking about Jesus in every other sentence, which you can't do, you can be Jesus-ly in whatever you teach. Which is like saying about teaching, you're not just a teacher, you're teacher-ly. And so you're Jesus-ly without ever having to mention him. And the light will come right through, you know, and so on and so forth. Now, having said all of these things, I just want to say finally that teaching is an act of worship, an offering placed as perfume on the Savior's feet. The richest perfume that you can find. And you pour it on Jesus' feet as an offering. And then if I can mix the metaphor and refer from one story to another in the Bible, you're also foot washers. You wash the children with the pure water of wisdom and knowledge, with Christ as the source of these and the treasure house of everything pertaining to wisdom and knowledge. So as you pour perfume on the feet of Jesus as teachers, you turn around with your basin of pedagogical water as pure as you can make it and wash the feet of these little children. So God bless you in all of your work there too, in His name. Yeah.
And you started to go down that road, and then you went into education in terms of
okay, good.
And you never finished.
Yeah. Well, what I did say was that he did not mean behave like little children, because I said that children, to me, are the quintessential narcissists.
Correct.
And civilization is part of the way of working narcissism out of them and putting it in the trash. And I did not go any further, because that's the only point that I wanted to make.
Oh,
I see. Christ.
If he says, be like little children, then what's he saying?
Yeah, he meant be vulnerable and believe everything you hear. Trust it. And you know doggone well that a little child will believe anything you say to them. Anything. So, and now see, here's where the sentence, they come with a sentence, we put the words in the sentence. So if we give them false words, whatever they are, cultural, whatever, they will believe them. I'm sure Christ meant that. And so for us to pray that we grow up as adults into being little children, it means to grow into that state of saying, when Jesus said, it is so, you say, yes, it is so. It is so. Okay? Thanks very much.